From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The New York Times, as part of its privacy project, has published an exclusive investigative account of how cell phone location data farmed by private companies through innocuous apps can be used to track our every move. Companies are gathering and storing this data, asking the public to trust that it's all anonymous, that they'll keep it safe and not sell it or disclose it to hackers. But the tracking data is easy to obtain and analyze and poses serious opportunities for abuses by both governments and corporations. My guest is Professor Jim Dempsey, Executive Director of the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology at the UC Berkeley School of Law. He's one of the experts quoted in the New York Times' investigative piece called One Nation Tracked. Welcome to the program, Jim.
Sonali, great to be with you. Thanks.
So first, let's try to understand what it all means, because sometimes some of the technological stuff feels overwhelming for people. We know that almost all of us these days have smartphones. And on those smartphones, we have apps that we install to do things like, you know, Skype with one another. How do those apps then lead to data gathering that someone else, somewhere else, that's invisible to you, actually tracks?
Right. So this all goes to the fact that our smartphones nowadays have a GPS chip in them, and that chip is constantly receiving data from the GPS satellites and is constantly calculating your location with remarkable precision. Now, what happens is these apps connect with that GPS chip through the operating system of the phone, and the apps pull the data off of your phone and deliver it to the app maker, who can use it, logically enough, to deliver maps and other location services. But then the app developer can go farther and redisclose that data to third parties who can use it then for all kinds of profiling and marketing purposes.
So information and the data about each and every one of us is currency these days in our digital age, right? Every click that we engage in on our computers is akin to every move that we make with our cell phones in our pockets that can then be this lucrative source of revenue for these companies. So there's third-party companies that are attempting to buy and are buying up this data. Who are these companies? The New York Times lists just some of them. I've never heard of most of them. These are companies that are solely engaged in the business of buying up location data?
Right. So these are companies that you have never heard of and the average consumer has never heard of, because the average consumer never interacts with them. Obviously, you know who your cell phone provider is, and it's not the cell providers that are at issue here. You know the apps that you use. You use Google Maps, you use Yelp, you use Facebook. And in a way, those are not the companies that we're talking about here. What happens is that the app developer, and I don't want to single out anyone specifically because you have to dig deep down into figuring out which one it is, but if you're using an app, that app developer will get your information, often in order to provide you with the functionality of the app, but then they will also sell it or share it or transfer it to yet another party, who may then transfer it to yet another party. And companies like Foursquare, which is named in the New York Times story, have grown up to basically draw information, insights about you from this information.
What are they doing with this information? They wouldn't be buying it up unless they could make money off of it.
Right. And a lot of it goes to this very, very complex ecosystem of marketing, traffic assessment, analysis. Stores want to know who's coming into their stores. Marketers want to know where you're going. They use that to help infer what your interests are. So it is tied in with this broader and very complex, very hard to penetrate ecosystem of profiling, advertising, just the whole way in which behind the scenes we are being rated and ranked and assessed and profiled.
So let's talk about what the New York Times did. It obtained this data, which we are told is so secure that we shouldn't worry about it. But it seems as though some, you know, concerned people who work in these companies who are kind of appalled at the potential for abuse shared it with the paper, and then the paper was able to analyze it?
Yeah, so this seems to have been an insider leak. Somebody at one of these companies got concerned, and it's just from one company covering a period of time, but it's billions of data points on millions or tens of millions of people, if not hundreds of millions. And the New York Times got this enormous data set. And what's most notable about the story, why it's getting attention, kudos to the New York Times, they put a lot of effort into analyzing this data and using various visual tools to present it. So I really encourage your listeners to actually go and look at the story online because it's got some phenomenal graphics that go with it where the New York Times basically did what anybody else could do with this data. The New York Times used, once they got the database, they used only open source information, only publicly available tools. But they identified people by name. They tracked their movements daily. And they present this all in a very compelling and fascinating way.
So essentially, you have these data points, each one of which represents a single, you know, cell phone sitting in someone's pocket. And the companies say, well, this is anonymous data. There's no names attached to it. And what the Times was able to prove that was really shocking was that it's I think it was their words were child's play to determine the identity of this person. So, for example, if I am just, you know, driving between home and work every single day, my data point is easily identifiable as long as you know where I work and just, you know, vaguely where I might possibly live.
Right. Well, when you think about it, unless you happen to work with your partner, your life partner, there is nobody else in the world, literally, who lives where you live and also works where you work. And those two points alone and, can be enough to then go to other publicly available sources and identify that person. Now, you know, privacy advocates, people concerned about privacy, have long known that this was possible and have long pointed out that so-called anonymous data is not really anonymous. You go back many years in the work of LaTanya Sweeney and showing the re-identification of seemingly anonymous data. What's unique here is the way the New York Times did it and mapped it to the location and how they were able, not just theoretically, but in reality, to show this very, very granular insights that can be developed about people from their location and then linked to other data and compiled into a package.
So they were able to track cell phones moving, using this data set that they obtained, moving in and out of the White House and the Pentagon. You know, we are told that there's all these security measures that people involved in the national security apparatus, you know, used to keep their data secure. But apparently, if you're a third-party company like Foursquare, you could just buy the data. And, you know, potentially, if you want, somewhere down the line, sell it to somebody who could make use of it. The New York Times points out that the potential for blackmail is huge.
Right. And what I was quoted on in the story was it less focused on the concern that the companies like Foursquare will use this for blackmail purposes or for illegal purposes. We should be concerned the way they're using it to decide how worthy we are of certain commercial interactions or certain commercial deals. But in terms of the blackmail, the real concern, of course, is that this information is sitting on computers and is vulnerable to hackers. The New York Times basically illuminated the insider threat, but there's also a hacker threat. And you have to assume, for example, that foreign governments are trying to hack into these databases. Foreign intelligence services know how these services work. And they're, I would suspect, undoubtedly targeting this kind of data to use for espionage purposes and to compromise people that they want to compromise for intelligence purposes.
Right. If you can track a person, if you identify a person's cell phone by their cell phone data and can track their every move, you can figure out if they're, you know, seeing a psychologist or having an affair or, you know, buying drugs or being, you know, being caught in incriminating circumstances that, you know, many of us take for granted are our private lives. Now, this issue of hacking is something that may sound far-fetched, but haven't we known in recent, just couple of years, massive amounts of data breaches from private corporations that have been hacked, like credit information, credit card information, and scores, credit scores, et cetera, all of that from various companies who, for various reasons, have had holes in their software have been hacked.
Right. And it used to be just criminals doing that, but we've become increasingly aware, of course, that nation states are doing it. And in ways that initially strike you as a little odd until you think about it. So, for example, the Anthem Health breach, which stole some medical ID information and other health insurance information, that was ultimately traced, I think, to the Chinese government. The Yahoo, the massive Yahoo breach, which stole some passwords, some usernames, in some cases, actual email content, some meaning millions of cases, that was traced to the Russian government and criminals working with the Russian government. And you say, well, why would the Chinese be interested in health data? Or why would the Russian government be interested in Yahoo usernames and passwords? And the fact is, this is part of the effort to gather more information on people and to put together these pieces. I mean, we live in the era of big data. We live in the era of data analytics and the ability to take massive amounts of data from disparate sources and put it together into a picture. And so you have to assume that foreign governments are doing that, targeting Americans. You have to assume at some level that some criminal gangs, possibly working with governments, possibly freelancing, are doing this. You look at the way in which people can be so easily smeared nowadays or painted in a false light or an embarrassing light. And it's really disturbing just when you think about the amount of information that's out there and potentially vulnerable.
And we know that, you know, places like Hong Kong, where protesters have used digital means of communication to organize, they've also been vulnerable to the Chinese government's very sophisticated surveillance machinery to keep track of them. And of course, combined with other technology like facial recognition, you can have a situation where authoritarian governments, including perhaps someday our own, could use that cell phone data and, you know, maybe even force companies to hand it over because it's there and available in order to criminalize dissent, right?
Oh, yeah, I think that's true. And I think it is, you're right, that it's a concern that we always have to have about our own government. And certainly we see it happening in real time in Hong Kong and other countries.
So this justification that apps give to collect this data in the first place, which they then turn around and sell to these third companies, is, as you mentioned earlier, a way to better market to people. And of course, we get from corporations this message constantly, well, we want a better user experience for the users. So the more data we can collect on you, the better user experience we can create for you. We can market to your personal tastes. It's as if we're being told this is just all for our benefit. So one can imagine an app like Yelp or Google Maps needing your location data, you know, to tell you where the closest restaurant is that you like, or the fastest way to get to another place. But there are many, many apps that have absolutely no need to track your location data, but do it anyway by default, unless you go into your phone and figure out how to turn it off, right?
Well, I think now both with iPhone and Android, any app that is going to draw location data from your operating system does need your prior permission, okay? It used to be, 5 or 6 years ago, that would occur automatically without any user knowledge or consent.
But are they asking, is the consent, you know, in the form of the question, can we track you? Or is it, can we ping you for or send notifications to your phone?
No, here's the thing. I think that the notice itself currently is pretty explicit. There may be some companies out there that are trying to evade it, and it has been found that some tried to evade it. But by and large, right now, the basic notice is pretty explicit. Do you, you get a little notice. This app requires or asks for or wants to use your location information. Allow, don't allow. Now, here's the problem. Many of us, many of the times, click or punch or tap allow, and then we forget about it.
Right.
And we never look back. You can look back. You can go to your iPhone right now. You can go to your Android. You can go into settings. You can look at location. You can look at every single one of your apps. And for every single app, you can see where you set the permission. Allow, deny, or allow only when in use. And I would urge all of your listeners to do that right now.
And in fact, the New York Times article has a separate section on some things that you can do right now, including what you just mentioned.
So here's the problem with consent. I mean, the companies argue, the companies engaged in this sort of ecosystem, the app developers and the third parties, they say, hey, look, everything here is consent. We have user permission for all of this. I think that's the limit, illustrates what's wrong with the consent-based model that has dominated our approach to privacy for the past 20 or 30 years. Because unfortunately, we all click yes. We all want the service. We all want the feature. We all want it right away. We all want it immediately. And then people, of course, load up their phones with lots of apps, just like probably some of these Secret Service agents identified by the New York Times did. It sounded like a good idea at the time. They clicked allow. They didn't pay a lot of attention to the granularity of the controls. And then that app just runs. And in many cases, whether you're using the app or not, if you made the wrong choice, even you're not using the app, it will still be drawing that GPS data from the operating system of the phone, disclosing it to the app developer, who then in turn will turn around and disclose it to yet another party.
Aren't these companies sweeping up this data because they can? Isn't it true that our federal regulations are so far out of date and just have not kept up with these digital jumps in the progress that digital technology has made?
You're right. But my point goes beyond that. And my point is that even if Congress enacted, states enacted, the strongest privacy proposals currently pending, which are the so-called express prior consent, opt-in, that would not fix this problem, because all of these companies say, all of our users already are giving us express prior permission. Now it's buried in these terms of service. And again, it's presented to you at the appropriate time when you're downloading the app, but right when you want the service. And so I think we need to rethink in a way where we put our emphasis on privacy. And I think, particularly in this case, it shows the limits of the consent-based model. I think instead we need to focus on necessity. Is the collection of the location data necessary for the app, for the service that you think you're getting? Is the disclosure to the third party necessary? Almost never is. And I think we need to think much more deeply about what privacy advocates refer to as data minimization and use limitations. You should only collect data for the purpose and use it only for the purpose that is related to the service or the product or the feature that you are engaging with. So yes, take your location data and use it for Google Maps, of course. Google Maps won't work otherwise. But don't then take that data and disclose it and use it for an unrelated purpose that has to do with marketing, advertising to you, profiling you by parties that you don't even know and don't interact with.
I'm wondering, Jim, if you think that the invisibleness of this phenomenon is a huge part of the problem. We don't really understand how dangerous this data collection is until and unless it is abused. And of course, that was the reason that the Times did this piece was before such an abuse can take place, they're pretty openly advocating for there to be greater controls on the system because, you know, we just think, well, what's the worst that could happen? We live in a relatively free society. We want to use all the latest gadgets and apps on our cell phone.
Exactly. And it's sort of, you know, death by a thousand cuts. Yeah. So we do the first day up and, oh, that's cool and that's great and how exciting. And then we do the next day up and then we do the next day up. And suddenly we've got, you know, for some people, dozens, if not 100 or more apps, any one of which or multiple of them could be collecting this data, even when you're not using the app. And disclosing it. And then, of course, these companies have arisen up that have these multiple relationships with what they call their partners, multiple partners. So they are compiling data, not from just one app, but from multiple apps.
And it's incredible if you think about the amount of data we're talking about. There's obviously millions of people, hundreds of millions of people in this country alone, most of whom, adults at least, are using cell phones. And we're talking about each individual person generating a ton of data points every day. So we're talking about potentially, what, trillions of data points of information.
Right. And, you know, we live now, again, in the era of big data, of artificial intelligence. So the ability to collect, store, process, analyze, and draw meaning, insight from that information is growing rapidly. Mm-hmm. So the appetite for this data and the ability to ingest and use this data and to at least purport to garner insights from it is constantly growing, equal to the pace of the growth of the data.
Are there members of Congress that you think are taking this issue seriously? Is there any legislation in the works?
So there has been, for years now, there has been calls for federal privacy legislation. For years now, various members of the House and Senate, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, Senator Maria Cantwell, others have been, Senator Patrick Leahy, have been calling for privacy legislation, have been pushing for it. The industry has fought back every step of the way. If anything, there are a number of companies who now say they support federal privacy legislation, but they support it only because they want a weak federal bill that will preempt the stronger state bills. There are a couple of big sticking points. One is whether consumers will be able to sue. The companies hate the notion that they can be subject to lawsuits by consumers. They want only regulators to regulate. They know that the regulators don't have the resources to really be comprehensive in their supervision and enforcement of privacy practices. So the companies oppose any legislation that would have a private right of action, and they only want legislation that would preempt stronger state laws, that would override stronger state laws. And those are the two big sticking points. Bills have been introduced, including a bipartisan bill. The bipartisan bill that was introduced just last week, I think, just recently. The bipartisan bill, interestingly, slices the baby, and it says no private right of action and no preemption. Maria Cantwell's bill, I think, has a private right of action and no preemption. And that's where the battle line is going to be drawn. Whether it will pass or not, I mean, you know, gridlock is the order of the day in Congress in a lot of respects. But with this public interest and articles like this one in the New York Times, this may give the impetus that's needed.
Well, let's hope so. I want to thank you so much, Jim, for joining us today.
My pleasure.
My guest has been Professor Jim Dempsey, Executive Director of the Berkeley Center for Law and Technology at the UC Berkeley School of Law. He is one of the experts quoted in the New York Times investigative piece called One Nation Tracked, which you can find online at nytimes.com/tracked. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. That was amazing.